Mega Sports Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Zach Harper. I'm joined by Matt Moore, senior blogger for CBS Sports. Previously on the podcast, Mike Brown's son, Elijah Brown, was getting death threats on Twitter, and Mike Brown was still the head coach of the Los Angeles Lakers. Since then, Matt, we've had a couple of changes.
Just a few.
Just a couple minor ones.
We recorded this at like 11 o'clock Mountain Time on... Or it was before that. It was like 10. It was like 9 o'clock Mountain Time on Friday.
Yeah, we went early.
And since between then and now on Monday morning, here I stand at 12 o'clock Mountain Time. The Lakers, I think, have gone through three coaches. Is that right?
I've got it at eight. I think that I feel like they hired Mike Dunleavy, Phil Jackson, and Jerry Sloan at some point during the weekend, and then settled on Mike D'Antoni.
Obviously, Mike Brown fired on Friday after you and I written about how, like, well, you can't make any decisions. And what was really – let's start with Brown getting fired because we actually didn't get a chance to talk about it.
Right.
I thought it was interesting because multiple people had indicated that the Buss family's policy, their plan, was to give Brown time, was to be patient, that they were going to hang out. You know, let's see how this works out. There's a lot of time left in the season. And then, like – It seemed randomly, it was like five games in, they just pulled the plug. They just completely flipped out. And, it's not that I don't think it was a good move, because I obviously think Mike D'Antoni is a huge improvement over Mike Brown. It was just really shocking for them to have put out all of this vibe about, we're going to hang with it. This is a long-term approach. And this is such a big thing for Jim Buss, for the guy that he picked to take the franchise going forward.
Well, weren't Bynum and Mike Brown both Buss guys, Jim Buss guys, and now both are gone within a few months of each other?
Yeah, I commented this on Twitter. Like, look at Jim Buss's last, like, 5 months. He went from a moron when they got eliminated from the playoffs,
right,
for choosing Mike Brown and for all the personnel decisions, to a genius when they landed Steve Nash, to a super genius when they landed Dwight Howard, to an idiot when they started 0-5, to a super idiot who had to fire his coach 5 games into the season, which a lot of people were like, if you're going to fire him 5 games in, why don't you fire him before the season? And so it's been really amazing to see, like, the way that perception has shifted on Jim Buss.
And even more so, shifted to, oh my God, he's a super genius again, when it looked like Phil Jackson was coming back. And now it's kind of like, he might have a dunce cap on, because people aren't crazy about Mike D'Antoni for some reason.
Yeah, and then what was also crazy is, look, if Phil Jackson was coming back, that meant Jim Buss was taking a step backwards.
Oh, like, yeah.
Like, Jim Buss very specifically, and it was well reported, he cleaned house. And it wasn't just Jackson and his coaching staff. Like, he changed, he removed any semblance of Phil Jackson from that building. Like, training staff got let go. Like, it was nuts, the level to which they purged Phil Jackson. And so to have brought him back would have been this massive, like, mea culpa to say, like, we were wrong to have ever, doubted the Zen Master.
And, it always has to be a soap opera, but I wonder how much of it was the Lakers seriously considering what it would take to bring Phil Jackson back and whether it was worth it or not. And by the Lakers, I strictly mean Jim Buss. Part of it could have been just let's screw with Phil a little bit here and see if he's interested and then pull the plug on him. Or let's legitimately venture into this territory of bringing him back. We'll never know, or maybe we will after there's a tell-all book or something. But it is kind of interesting to think about. I wonder how much of this was a mind game, a power trip kind of thing.
Well, I think a lot of it was, okay, we'll let him back in the building. You can coach. And then, Jackson, by all reports, didn't want to coach road games, wanted more control over basketball operations, one was going to get paid, commensurate with what he's worth on the open market, considering his championship experience and playing, being the coach of the Lakers. And that's a huge investment for a guy that wasn't going to coach for half the games of the season, or at least not, missing a ton of games with them being on the road. That's a pretty tall order to ask of an organization, even the Lakers. And Jackson had the luxury of being able to do that because, one, he spelled Jackson, and, two, he's retired. I mean, you could just be like, oh, that's fine. I'll be over here smoking peyote. Have fun.
I wonder if there was some angle with Phil Jackson, because there seemed like, you know, he was going to make an effort to try to get Brian Shaw away from the Pacers and back into his camp. I wonder if there was part of it where Phil was trying to get Brian Shaw set up again to take over that Lakers team, because that seemed like a very important thing to him.
Yeah, that wouldn't surprise me. I mean, you know, you know how coaches are with their assistants. Like, they really try to look out for their guys.
Yeah.
And Shaw got so screwed by that entire situation, so it wouldn't surprise me in the least of have seen that been a factor. And when they said, they came out on Friday and said, in the press conference for Brown's firing, Kupchak said, you know, we're not going to look at somebody who's under contract right now. I was like, that means they don't want Shaw back. And I was like,
right.
That's significant. That's going to have an impact on things. Which, not to say that I didn't think they were going to get Phil. I was convinced as of Sunday night before the news hit, I was convinced that it was going to be Jackson. I want to say, you want to know what? Here's why I really feel bad about Mike Brown. I feel like if he had not gotten offered that job, if they'd gone with Adelman or if something, you know, if whatever had happened, if they'd gone with Shaw, I feel like Mike Brown had a pretty good chance to have wound up taking the Bobcats job, and I feel like he would have done a pretty good job with that. I feel like there's a lot of gigs that Mike Brown could take over and do a really good job at. The Lakers were just the least of those opportunities.
And it's weird because, you know, if your star player doesn't respect you overtly and make it really obvious, then you're just doubted as a coach, which is valid on some level. It didn't look like LeBron, you know, had his full support behind Mike Brown. It didn't look like Kobe had his full support behind Mike Brown. And you're dealing with two guys with, you know, vastly bigger egos than the average athlete, and rightfully so, because they are that good to where it makes sense. But that's not how every star would be, and maybe that stigma follows him and keeps him out of a job with the next organization that is looking, that has a star. Yeah, maybe I'm presuming too much here, but it does seem like it wasn't a fair shake for one. He either should never have gotten the job, or he should have been fired after the first year, not five games into a full season. And it really, like, I hope it doesn't keep him from really getting a legitimate shot in the league again. It probably won't, but you never know with these kind of things. You look at PJ Carlissimo, definitely more extreme circumstances with Sprewell choking him and everything. But that, I mean, that stigma can stick with you if it looks like you can't get along with your star.
He, I think it's the Kobe Brown thing. I think is really interesting. I wrote Friday about how, to me, this thing was doomed from the start just because they didn't clear the hiring with him.
Yeah.
And that, to me, says a lot. Like, I think that that's like, I think that that says a lot about kind of the situation. And that was, to me, was where things started to go bad. Was, you know, Kobe did actually a really good job of publicly saying, I support this guy, I'm really behind him.
Yeah, he really did.
To reporters. Like, he really tried, and even like last week, he said, I've had his back the entire time. But it's interesting because despite saying all that, really quietly, I wrote a thing on LeBron commenting on Mike Brown, but also our former colleague at Ion Basketball, Ben Galler, now writing for SI, tracked down an Oregonian quote from Marcus Aldridge, where Aldridge said basically, well, I heard some stuff about Kobe being unhappy, and if that's the case, you're not going to last.
Yeah.
And so it was like, you know, you wonder if Bryant was, like, you know, willing to give him the shot, was okay with last year, felt okay coming in. They lost the first game okay. They lost the second game okay. They lost the Clippers game. Things are kind of bad. And then that Jazz loss was what clicked it. It's funny because we made so much a big deal out of the death stare, which was just him staring into space. But it's like, you wonder, like, was that the game that did it, you know?
Yeah.
Like, was that the game that wound up taking him out, you know, because that really seemed to be the end of it. You know, for Jackson, I wrote about in the inbounds this morning. I wrote about this, which is, I'm really glad that they went with D'Antoni because this is going to be so much more interesting. Ken Berger he's sad that the Jackson didn't come back. Howard Beck of the New York Times will be sad because he covered Phil for years and loves him and has written about how great he is. Like, Jackson is a beat writer's wet dream. Like, he is fantastic. His quotes are terrific. He needles other coaches.
Especially in the playoffs.
Yeah. He does all the stuff that really drives copy and makes it really entertaining and easy. Like, he writes your column for you because of the way that he talks about basketball. And, like, you know, I've listened to him speak in pregame stuff before, and he is very engaging, and it makes you like, oh, like, that's very interesting. And, like, he's a very colorful personality. But we've been down that road so much, and instead we get something really innovative and really different. Now, I don't think that's necessarily better, but I think it's going to be a lot more interesting, and I'm really excited to see what this looks like, because this is going to be really fascinating with Mike D'Antoni.
I think it's more interesting from a fact outside of Lakers fans, which, you know, obviously we have different goals than what Lakers fans have goals for the team. For Lakers fans, I think that they don't care about interesting. They obviously care about wins and winning another championship, which is really the right thing. And if you think Phil Jackson gives you the best chance of winning a championship, it's true. For us, you know, I don't really care if the Lakers win a championship or they don't. Like, I know the Timberwolves aren't going to win a championship. That's where my allegiances lie. So after that point, I don't care who wins it. I have no problem with the Lakers winning the title. If they win it with D'Antoni, it's more interesting to me because it's a new coach winning a title. It's a new system with a new team rather than the older system that we know works a lot of the time. And I think that for everyone outside of, you know, quote-unquote Laker Nation, I agree with you. It is much more interesting. I don't know that Lakers fans care about more interesting.
No, they don't. And nor should they.
Right, they should.
But I also don't necessarily think this is a disappointing thing. It's one where, you know, also, if this works, this could be something that can be a little bit more sustainable. And honestly, and, you know, Bill Simmons actually commented on this. I thought that was a good point. Like, Jackson was checked out. Jackson checked out in 2011. He was out the door mentally. And that team really fell apart because he wasn't able to keep them involved. Now, D'Antoni's not going to do a lot. I think Kobe mentioned over the weekend a quote about Bernie Bickerstaff, which is amazing, which is just that he knew – he knows to get the expletive out of the way.
Right.
And that's going to be a lot of this, is abandoning all the strict system and the strict principles and doing a lot more things to kind of play to their strengths. There's been a lot of talk about how Kobe's going to fit into the system. I think he's going to actually get fit really great because of the number of times that D'Antoni tends to post wings in the system.
Yeah.
Bryant's such a fantastic post player. That could work really well. I love Howard in the pick and roll with Nash. Like, that's what needs to be their bread and butter. You know, they'll get lots of opportunities for Pau Gasol. He'll know how to use him. I think that as far as the shooters go, I think if you've got, you know, Bryant and you've got, you know, I think even Jody Meeks, yes, I think Artest is going to be an issue. But Artest is going to be a problem anyway. You knew coming in that Artest is going to have to space the floor and that he's not good at that. So,
right.
You know, there's no way to make Ron Artest into a good offensive component.
And you know, I wrote about this for Ion Basketball. It's really, you know, you put Dwight Howard as the Amari role. You put Pau Gasol as the Boris Diaw role, which I think is maybe the most fascinating. But I feel like I'm more obsessed with Pau Gasol than most Lakers fans, or really most basketball fans. I think people just don't care about him anymore, and I still want to defend him and believe that he's still awesome. Because I think he is, and
he's
putting
so skilled.
He's just
exceptionally skilled. The Diaw comparison had me like flipping out last night when I realized that.
Yeah, and you put him in the Boris Diaw role from the, what was it, 06 team, where even when Amari was hurt, and even when Amari came back, that's an awesome role for Pau Gasol to be in, and then you have Artest as the Sean Marion, and you think, well, he's nothing like Sean Marion, but with Dwight Howard defending the paint, he doesn't have to be. You know, he doesn't have to be that do-it-all defender that Marion was. He just has to be a decent perimeter defender. And offensively, you're dead on about putting Kobe in the post, which D'Antoni will probably do a lot. I love Kobe in the pick and roll. He's such a good passer. You know, he's got the stigma as a gunner, and, you know, probably should, but he's such a good passer, and he's so good scoring in the pick and roll that I think that's going to be a pretty natural fit. The thing I worry about is the shooters. Yeah, Nash will probably still be a great shooter. Kobe has been trending downward in spot-up shooting over the last three seasons. We have an extremely small sample size now, but he is shooting well. so far this season, but it's been like 11 spot up threes, and he's not shooting nearly enough to give you any idea whether he's going to be good or bad in the long run. You know, can Jody Meeks be not just a 36% three-point shooter, but a 40% three-point shooter? That's tough to tell. He probably should. Can Darius Morris thrive in this offense? I think he's a big X factor because of his skill set. Not a great shooter, but I think if you give him a lot of open looks, he'll be fine. And then does Anton Jameson have any kind of life? Is he a corpse in the system still? Like, what, you know, what does the bench do under D'Antoni?
I think there's a lot of things to sort out. You know, Antoine Jameson's role. I think Antoine could be really great in this. And then there are, I think, questions. And the biggest one is, you know, is the health going to hold up? Like, can they play in the fast? They're not going to be as fast as they're not going to be at 7SOL. They just won't be because they don't have the guys that can hold up. You know, they can run some half court stuff. It'll be interesting to see what D'Antoni does because he's got the opportunity now. He's a creative basketball mind. He's not reliant upon one system. He has basic tenets that he likes to focus on, but he can build something entirely new here.
Sure.
And the creativity, I think, is key here because you need to have a guy that's willing to think outside the box and yet not build a system so rigid. Like, he's going to just basically say, well, I'm going to put my guys in the best position possible. You know, in Phoenix, he had so much success because what he did was he looked at it and he said, okay, well, Nash is our best, you know, ball handler and creator, let's let him start everything. Amari's our best pick and roll finisher, let's have him be the big, you know, let's start everything with them and then we'll figure out everything else. And I think that they're going to do the same thing with the Lakers. He'll figure out a way to get everything, and he and Kobe have a good enough relationship to where I don't think that that's a huge part of this, is that anybody else, I think, with D'Antoni's style and credentials would be in trouble, but because of the relationship that those two specifically have, that's huge, because you've got no question about Bryant buying in.
Yeah, I think enough guys on that team respect him, or, you know, the guys with the biggest voices. I really don't see Kobe having a problem with D'Antoni, because aside from the melodrama, D'Antoni really hasn't had a lot of issues with players, I don't feel like. I mean, Marion had his issues, but Marion wanted to be a bigger star. Kobe's already the biggest star, so what issues is he going to have there? And Kobe's skill set fits better into D'Antoni's system far better than Melo's did.
Yeah, much, much better. I think that'll be interesting because it's going to be that'll be something to watch, you know, with Melo and Kobe in terms of if Kobe can make it work or Melo did not. I think that'll be an interesting subplot.
Here's a question I have for you. Is Dwight going to like Mike D'Antoni?
You know, I think so because because
honestly, I have no read on that. You know, I know he's got Olympic history, whatever, but who knows if that is enough. I mean, Kobe's relationship with D'Antoni goes deeper than the Olympic history.
I think it's mostly that D'Antoni's really laid back, and so I don't think that. And D'Antoni's also one of those guys that's aware of how much more there is to life than basketball.
Sure.
And that's going to resonate well with Howard because Howard's never really focused on basketball. You know, he is. He's worked extremely hard. But, you know, I do think he gets – that was one of his problems with SVGs. He got worn down because of the hyper-focus.
Sure.
And I think that's something that he'll look forward to as a coach. You know, and I think that D'Antoni also, again, is one of those guys that if you're really great, he's not gonna get away from that. Like, he's not a guy that's ever going to be like, well, you have your limitations or I don't really trust this. He's going to be like, you're Dwight Howard. We're going to get you the ball. And I think that will make him feel better. The big concern from Lakers fans, obviously, and let's go ahead and talk about this to get out the way, is defense. And
yeah, that was my next question for you. Ken Berger put up a report that they're possibly looking into Nate McMillan as the defensive assistant.
Well, let's go a couple ways. Let's start with the D'Antoni question, because the perception is that D'Antoni, you know, is a terrible defensive coach, that he doesn't give any emphasis on defense, and that they are simply – his teams are always bad. Now, I am not going to sit here and tell you that D'Antoni is Tom Thibodeau. Like, I'm not going to sit here and say that
– Breaking news.
Right. I'm not going to sit here and say that he is this defensive genius. What I am going to say is that as much as I talk about how defense is more reliant upon system than personnel does play a huge factor into it. And the other thing I would say and point this out, and this needs to be noted because people do not catch this. You know, this is where points per game gets into a very, very – this is the damage it can do. Because people will only look at the points per game, and they won't evaluate, you know, per possession. There's a reason that everybody smart that's talking about basketball right now is talking about per possession statistics, because you have to be able to measure how much, like, the pace of the game. If you play really fast, you're going to give up a lot of points, or comparatively, because you have more possessions. But so then this is really key right here. Last year with the New York Knicks, and this is pre-All-Star game, pre-All-Star game in New York, which is, you know, he was fired at the trade deadline, which is 2 weeks after after the All-Star game. Pre-All-Star game, New York had a 97.2 defensive efficiency.
That's good.
After the All-Star game, they had a 99.8. They played better defense before the All-Star break with Mike D'Antoni in the period from after until he got fired with Mike Woodson took over through the rest of the year. Now, there were injuries involved in that, and Mike Woodson had a huge part of that success.
Oh, yeah.
But the point is, Mike D'Antoni is not in a situation where he's never been a coach of a top 10 defense. He had a top 10 defense last season. So you can build it if you build it right. Basketball Twitter right now is on fire because Nate McMillan is being brought in as a defensive assistant, and everyone's, you know, throwing out the defensive efficiency numbers as the end-all be-all. Now, the problem is, like, you have to take all these numbers in context. And for me, I'm looking at it and I'm like, look, I don't think Nate McMillan is, again, he's not Tom Thibodeau. That's why Tom Thibodeau has a head coaching job in Chicago. You know, he's not one of these guys. I do know that I've always liked what I've seen from Portland defensively. They've been disciplined, and they've played hard in terms of their scheme. I also look at it and I say, look, Brandon Roy was their best player, and they had nothing but young guys for many, many years under McMillan. You know, I don't know how you can build. I look at that roster, and I'm not sure how you build a really stout defensive team with that unless you're Tom Thibodeau. So I think there's potential there for this to work out fine. And again, I'm in a situation with these Lakers where I'm like, you don't have to, like, your system doesn't have to be perfect. Dwight Howard's going to get you half of the way there. You just right. have to be good enough to get you within range. He'll take you home. And the same thing with your offense. You don't have to be a genius at offense. You just have to be good enough to get him in a good position. And Steve Nash and Kobe Bryant, Dwight Howard and Pau Gasol are going to take you home.
Right. And I think it was 2007. The Phoenix Suns were the 13th best defense in the league, and they lost in. They also had the best offense. They lost in the semifinals to the Spurs. You know, 13th in the league is pretty decent. I think if you're in the top 15, you're good enough defensively. It shows you can get some stops, and if your offense is that good, you know, you need a balance between the two. You need a healthy balance between offense and defense, and we've seen that every season. Maybe the Pistons are the exception because they seem pretty brutal offensively, even in their championship year. Let me check that real quick. Yeah, their championship year, the Pistons were 18th in offensive rating, which not that good, second in defense, but there was a decent enough balance. And I feel like with D'Antoni, you know, by the time the playoffs come, I don't even look at this season. It's possible he'll get fired 5 games in the next season. Who knows? It's Jim Buss. But you look at this season, they have essentially a year to get familiar, get the system implemented, do a little trial and error this season. You get a full training camp. You maybe bring in two shooters, a little bit more depth on the perimeter. They don't even have to be good all-around players. You could bring in the next Eddie House. Hell, you could bring in Eddie House. and see where that gets you. And then, like, I look at this as a championship move for next season. Everyone assumed a championship or championship possibility this year. I still think it's possible, but it just seems it's pretty unprecedented for a guy to take over in season and turn him into a title team. I believe Pat Riley did it, but that was, you know, a little bit different. And I think that with D'Antoni, you're trying to guarantee a title by 2014, by the summer of 2014, right? Does that seem fair?
Yeah.
And so if they don't win one this season, everyone will talk about what a horrible hire it is and what a horrible decision it is. Kind of like after 2011 when Eric Spoelstra should have been fired.
Yep.
And I just feel like they just have to have a balance defensively. Those Portland teams with Nate McMillan, the first couple years they had, they were at the bottom of the league. I think they were also rebuilding those years. They had a couple, I think, in like the 13 range. They had one top 10 defense. I don't know that Nate McMillan solves their defensive problems, but I don't think he hurts them at all. I mean, it's just, it's going to be such a weird situation with an essentially new coaching staff taking over 2 weeks into the season or 3 weeks or whenever D'Antoni is healthy enough to be on the sidelines after his knee surgery, that trying to predict and judge what's going to happen in a matter-of-fact way just seems it always is, but it's just complete guesswork. And I don't know that we have an answer one way or another. Hell, if they win the title this year, even people are saying, hey, it might take a little while for things to get right, those people are wrong because, you know, they win one right away. Who knows? I just think that the important thing is that they get an identity. Like, that's what it seemed like they weren't comfortable with Mike Brown, at least through the first five games. I don't know how you have an identity 5 games into a season with big-time new teammates and a new system. That seems pretty unlikely to happen. But now there is a set identity on the horizon with the Lakers, and I think that's important, especially for a veteran team that kind of has a little bit more pressure to get things done sooner than later.
I will say this, you know, Lakers fans better be prepared for this to be patient, because
that'll happen.
They are not going to buy out Mike Brown's contract, but then turn around and pay out Mike D'Antoni $14 million.
And then pay Phil Jackson.
That's not happening. Like, you cannot spend $25 million on a coach.
Not even the Lakers.
Maybe they don't care. Not even the Lakers. Maybe. Not even with the $5 billion. And the Nets, yeah, I think the Nets might be willing to do that. But, you know, the Lakers won't do that. So they're going to have time. The best thing, I think, for D'Antoni this season is to really be like, look, you know, I want us to do these basic things. I want us to play faster. I want us to start the offense with this. I want these rotations. I want these kind of things. But in general, to be like, I want you guys to figure it out on your own. Like, do what you feel like you need to do and just play basketball. If you feel like we're in a place where we need more organization, let's get there. And then, like, give them a year and then start working in more of what you want. Because the worst thing I think you can do is don't try and cram a lot in this year. Because if you just let them play, that's the thing. Is like, you're looking at this team with Bernie Bickerstaff, you know, they've won 2 straight, like, and they looked impressive. Like, once they got out of their whatever it was that was in their heads under Brown,
right?
You know, they've been playing a lot better. And I've talked a lot about, like, you know, everyone talks about the triangle, and to me, the biggest thing with Jackson, and we talked about this on the podcast before, is it gets back to, you know, great coaches understand how to let their best players take control of the game,
right,
and to make decisions and to trust them and to have their respect and to respect them. And Jackson would have done that, but I think D'Antoni will do that too. I think part of that is Nash having his back, I think, will help a lot. I think that having he's got at least two of the guys. He's got the biggest personalities probably on that team. Not personalities, but, you know, the biggest leaders on that team. And Kobe and Nash are both very much going to be on board, and they're going to be okay with that. Question, if you're Mike D'Antoni, who's the better backup point guard for your system? Is it Chris Duhon or Darius Morris?
I don't understand why Chris Duhon is even on a basketball team. So I am not going to even consider him to be a backup option. I would play Darius Morris 1,000 times before I played Chris Duhon once.
I'm kind of excited about the idea of Darius Morris in the system. Like, I'm actually kind of looking at him like, you know? Because I was the same way actually with the triangle. The only thing that really interested me about the triangle is I was thinking about Jordan Hill, Antoine Jameson, and Jody Meeks running it.
Oh my God.
It's terrible.
That sounds awful.
But it's interesting. Like, to me, it's a lot more interesting than Kobe, Powell, and Dwight.
Sure.
So I think it'll be kind of – I think the way that he uses the second unit will be interesting. And you know, if Darius Morris can kind of turn into maybe a Leandro Barbosa kind of player for him. I don't know. It's weird because we're all comparing them. I do think that one thing we have to be careful about is, you know, we really are – we're all looking at the Suns team as the model. And I'm like, look, D'Antoni did coach several years in New York.
and there were some
bad teams in New York. They had terrible personnel. But it'll be kind of interesting to see also. Like, he tends to create guys and their numbers do go up. And somebody commented about how, like, that's a good thing. Like, the production, like, should the production go up if you're a good coach? I'm wondering if Jordan Hill's, like, production is going to, like, go through the roof. Because we've seen guys get, like, super high rebounding rates.
Man, I'm going to have so much crow to eat if D'Antoni turns Jordan Hill into a good NBA player, like even just a good
really
bench player.
Down on him, and I've really been impressed with him over the last 2 seasons.
I wouldn't say I've been impressed. I mean, he's been less fecal matter than before. but I still think he's a pretty awful player. There were plays last night, and God, it's three possessions, so it doesn't really mean anything, but like the guy's never expecting a pass.
That's true.
It doesn't matter. I mean, you would think that he's playing blindfolded out there. He's just never expecting a pass, and I have a hard time buying into guys who just seem like they have poor anticipation skills.
Yeah, I can understand that. I mean, I like him as just like a tap back, you know, tap ins, rebound. I like his defense, actually, especially.
That's fair. He's become a pretty decent defender.
Like I have very low expectations for bench bigs. I'm just like,
yeah,
don't be awful. This is like really where I get to in terms of defensively. That's kind of my focus.
Yeah.
Two things I want to touch on in other matters before we.
Wait a sec. There are other matters than what's going on with the Lakers head coaching staff.
An audacious thought. I know. How about Memphis beating the pants off of the Heat yesterday?
Holy! That was a performance. My guy Wayne Ellington making it. Wayne. I love that guy. If they hadn't traded him for a guy like Dante Cunningham, I would have been bummed about it because I just liked having him in the locker room and having him on the team. But I love seeing Wayne Ellington go on a shooting spree. It doesn't happen that often.
I was going to say, it's kind of interesting because you're very selective on which Wolves draft players that didn't amount to as much as they probably should have, you're kind to. Because, I'm not hearing a whole lot of Johnny Flynn deserves another chance in this league. Not hearing a lot
Which
of
is
that.
Weird because Johnny's such a good guy. He's just not an NBA player.
Just not an NBA player. Wayne Ellington is my new hero today. That bench unit is just, it's fantastic, and I really worried about it early on and with Arthur out, but man, like, Jared Bayless had chase down block yesterday. He's running an efficient offense and not trying to do too much. Ellington is the corner spot up three guy. Spates is anchoring it inside in terms of getting rebounds and making some mid-range jumpers and helping out with screens. Like, Memphis is at a really terrifying level right now, and even Rudy Gay's getting into it. I mean, it's a bummer to me though, because I'm just like, why can't this be later in the season? I know that they're going to fall off and look horrible for some stretch during January or February, and I'm going to completely abandon all hope.
How about Mike Conley yesterday?
Oh man, Mike Conley's so good. He's so good. He's so patient. He's got such good handle. He's so decisive now. Like, the game is just moving. Like, he's into that zone where veteran guys kind of get to when they hit his age, where everyone else is kind of looks to be moving in slow motion, and he knows where he's going and what he's doing before everyone else does. Because, like, I noticed, like, that's why Andre Miller is so good and why he's able to get past all of his physical limitations is he knows what you're going to do before you do it, and he's already moved around you.
Yeah. You know what? He just watching him last night and so far this season, he reminds me of an extremely talented Avery Johnson.
Yeah, that's a good comparison.
He kind of manages the game in the same way. Only, you know, he can knock down shots. He's a better setup guy. He's got a better handle. He's just a fantastic defender.
Yeah, he's got a lot better defensively too. That was everything that was a problem for him when some idiot writer like said that he was the worst player in the NBA a couple of years ago, worst starting point guard in the NBA a couple of years ago. He's improved on every single facet. It's been really amazing. And he's such a good leader for that team. Conley's just, he's really terrific. I think it's, they're really dynamic right now. I don't know what to do because it's like they're still playing awesome defense and their offense is getting to be where it's dynamic. You mentioned Avery Johnson, who used to play for the Spurs. You know who else used to play for the Spurs? Sean Elliott.
Oh,
Sean Elliott used to play for the Spurs.
Oh boy.
Sean Elliott, why must you be you, Sean Elliott? Why must you be all the things that you are?
He does that every so often. He acts like Sean Elliott. He has a tendency to be Sean Elliott.
For those of you that don't know what we're talking about, we've got a story up on CBSSports.com. DeMarcus Cousins suspended 2 games, served the first game last night. Zach wrote about it, based off of an altercation with Sean Elliott after the Kings-Spurs game. Essentially, Cousins was playing well with Duncan, mouthed off about him.
What? Cousins mouthed off?
Yeah. Duncan went on a huge run and did Duncan things. And then Sean Elliott was like openly and loudly talking about how you don't come in and talk smack about one of the greatest of all time and all of these things about Tim Duncan. Cousins took exception with it, you know, met up with him afterwards. They referred to it as an altercation. There wasn't, as far as we know, there wasn't anything physical. Just that it was an animated conversation. You know, and it's, Cousins has problems, and you know about them from your time in Sacramento, and he still has these issues, and he's going to be like this for at least another couple of years. But the reaction from anybody that's listened to Sean Elliott do a telecast outside of San Antonio is, oh, God, Sean.
Yeah, you know, Sean Elliott just, I get it. 11 of his 12 seasons in the NBA, he played for the Spurs. He was a teammate of Tim Duncan's. He won a championship with Tim Duncan. You know, Sean Elliott is a Spur, and I get that. And, you know, broadcasters are essentially, in one way or another, paid by the team in a way, or paid by someone very affiliated with the team to talk about their team in a mostly positive way and to essentially kind of sell tickets in a way. You know, you make them sound good. You make them sound great on the on TV, which is not hard to do with the Spurs. Very good team. And it makes people want to watch them in person instead of watching on TV. I mean, that's just part of what the industry is now, and I get that, and I'm fine with that. There, it does seem to be a line that Sean Elliott crosses, and maybe it's just his cadence is off-putting to people. Maybe it's just too much we, not enough analysis, too much defensive analysis. Not about defense, but just being defensive about the team. You know, there's something very horrible about the way Sean Elliott calls a game in a lot of, I would say, casual NBA fans' minds, or at least the casual online NBA fan who seems to talk about it on Twitter or talk about it in blogs, in comments or whatever. And I'm sure there are a lot of Spurs fans that love him because all he does is talk how great their favorite team is. And you know, that's kind of his role. But Sean Elliott is a guy that it's going for the people in the circles we run with, i.e. basketball nerds who are online talking about basketball, it's hard to gain a lot of favor or a lot of reverence for him in that you shouldn't challenge him.
Let's do one game for tonight before we get out of here. The closest games are kind of terrible, so let's not focus on those. Actually, let's talk about Wolves. We got Wolves Mavericks. Mavericks giving 6.5 at home.
I'm so sick of injury talk. I can't even tell. And it's not even like I care they're injured, but I don't really care that they're injured because injuries happen. But when I have people like start saying, "Oh, do you think the Wolves are cursed? Do I think a basketball team is cursed?" I really don't. I think they're cursed. I think teams can be cursed by horrible ownership. Like Donald Sterling with the Clippers. I think that's a curse of sorts, but no, I don't think there's like an injury curse. Now,
is this the 1800s?
Right, exactly. I don't know that there was like a voodoo curse or there's a voodoo doll or some kind of, I'm really throwing voodooism just under the bus here, but you know, I really don't, I mean, it's hard for me to believe in that kind of stuff. Injuries happen and there's the talk of, you know, someone was talking about how maybe we should start looking at the training staff of being incompetent, blah, blah, blah. And yeah, that might be valid, but if you look at it, the injuries are a lot of freak injuries. And most injuries are, which makes it highly coincidental. The only one that isn't is Brandon Roy's degenerative knees. You know, yeah. That and everything else, like Kevin Love did knuckle pushups, which is stupid, and broke his hand. Ricky Rubio planted incorrectly on a closeout on Kobe Bryant last year and tore his ACL. J.J. Barea went flying into a scorer's table, sprained his foot. Chase Budner got tied up on a loose ball and twisted his knee and tore his meniscus and will be out probably 6 to 8 weeks. You know, these are just freak occurrences, and they're not the only team dealing with injuries. Like, the Mavericks have Dirk out and I believe Sean Marion's still out. You know, like, people are dealing with injuries. That's what happens.
Bulls-Celtics tonight. What do you like? Bulls are given 3 at home.
I watched the Bulls dismantle the Wolves. The Wolves kept it close on the road, which is admirable. But that Bulls defense is just so good. I mean, they really just dare you to bring it inside.
Celtics have gotten close wins against bad teams. And, you know, they lost the Sixers. So they've had some bad moments, too.
They are a much better team on the road this year. 2-1 as opposed to 1-2. That is a significant difference.
Yeah, that's huge. Much, much, much better. You know, I'm going with Chicago. Boston's a mess right now. I think they'll be fine because I have no choice but to believe that they'll be fine. But, you know, Chicago right now, and again, I knew this was going to happen where I would doubt the Bulls based off of what they look like on paper, and Tibbs would make them into something better. And we're seeing it once again.
Yeah, oddly enough, I have been touting the Bulls as a great regular season team that I still think they'll be a top four team in the East because of their defense. I'm taking the Celtics tonight because I believe Heinrich is hurt, and that means a lot of Nate Robinson, a lot of Marco Bellinelli. Those two combined for 29 points off the bench against the T-Wolves in a 7-point victory. I don't think they're getting 29 points tonight, and that's why I would go with the Celtics on the road. That's strictly annoyance with the Kevin Hart of the NBA, Nate Robinson. Like, I just can't do it anymore. I can't pretend to enjoy watching him on the court. He seems like a nice guy. I just physically can't do it anymore.
I think we're good here.
Last one I find very interesting. The Bucks and Sixers.
I hate this line. I hate it. I hate it. I hate it. I want it to die. The line is Sixers giving 4. I hate it. I hate it. I hate that line. I cannot, like, because that literally, like, almost killed me this morning. I'm on 3.5 hours sleep. I'm about to die, like, trying to write all this stuff about D'Antoni. I'm sitting here and I'm looking at this line trying to do the picks this morning, and I'm just like, the Bucks have looked good, but they lost to the Celtics. But the Sixers have looked good, but they don't have anybody. They get Jason Richardson back, but the Bucks should be much better, but they usually aren't. I don't know what to do with it. I don't know what to do with it. All I know is this game will be ugly. That's the only thing I know.
You know, maybe last thing we should talk about before I click the old stop button. Andrew Bynum news.
Man.
This is the concern with him, is that he's not healthy. He's never healthy enough.
I said this morning, is it possible, like, you know, Denver is getting really good returns early from Andre Iguodala on defense, but if it wasn't for that, you could make the argument that no one won the Dwight Howard trade.
until Nikola Vucevic emerges as the best player from the trade.
Like now that the Magic are back down, you know, the Lakers are above 500, but still, like, no one won the Dwight Howard trade because the Sixers, you know, the Sixers are still winning, which is a real testament to Doug Collins and what he's able to do. But God, like, they've got to get him back. And, you know, December 10th is when he's going to be able to return to basketball activities, which means, you know, that's still 3 to 4 weeks until they said 3 to 4 weeks until he's going to be back on the floor. But here's my problem. Bynum always takes 2 to 3 weeks after when he's supposed to be back. Like, this is what he's done every single time his knee's been injured. Like, this could realistically be mid-February to March. I would not shock me if it was mid-February to March before he's back. And by that point, I don't think they have enough to survive.
Yeah, it would probably, I mean, if he's back anywhere around the start of the new year, I would be pretty shocked just because, yeah, maybe it's 3 to 4 weeks before he's back on the court, but that doesn't mean he's back in games. That just means he's back on the court trying to get into shape again, trying to test his knee.
So all in all, you know, Dwight Howard's situation worked out great for everyone.
Just fantastic. You know who it worked out well for? Mike D'Antoni.
Mike D'Antoni.
Just really worked out well for him, and even for Phil Jackson a little bit. He got his name in the paper for a couple of days.
It's like that scene from Billy Madison. He's losing his mind. I'm reaping all the benefits.
I hate that movie. I gotta say, I hate that movie. I don't find it funny at all. And I know this is a great way to end a basketball podcast, but I hate that movie.
Good for you.
I'd watch Mr. Deeds before I watch
it. Yeah, I'm going to take a nap now.
All right.